This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martoreno. You find us here, hopefully, on Saturdays talking about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and we will have more about them straight ahead. We're really grateful to our guest today on the program. We like to do this very often, and that is give you a first-hand and up-close and personal story about recovery, because that, of course, is the dirty little secret about this disease of addiction, and that is that millions of people manage to get sober. Millions are living in long-term sobriety. There's a lot of strength in hearing the stories of a successful recovery. So that's what we do today by reaching out to April Hartman.
April, hi.
Hi, April. How are you? Thanks for joining us here on Recovery Radio.
You know, I'm excited to be here.
I like to say that all stories of substance abuse and recovery are the same, except they're different. And as I looked at your bio notes and all that, I went, yeah, here's another interesting person who unfortunately had this disease and managed to battle back. And she's going to tell us about how she did that, her background, and how music has played a critical role in her sobriety and in her helping other people in similar situations. So we welcome April Hartman to Recovery Radio. April, let's get to know you. Tell us a little about yourself. Where were you born and who's your family?
I was born in Staten Island, New York. I grew up there, upper middle class family, Catholic school, had everything I ever needed growing up. Basically a really good childhood. I was given all the tools to succeed in life. Typical story.
Do we determine how old you are? I may have neglected that.
Oh, I'm 27 years old.
27 years old. So okay. Catholic girl. Catholic schools? How about siblings? You had brothers and sisters?
Oh, yeah. I have one sister. Later in life, I ended up with two stepbrothers.
Mm-hmm. And you characterized it as that's sort of like the standard American, all-American family background, correct?
Yeah, up until a certain point.
Yeah. Well, take us there. So what about that certain point?
So my mother actually struggled with addiction as well, and that was a drama that tore our family apart. Mm-hmm. When I was about 10 years old, it reached a breaking point where they were splitting up. Basically, my mom and dad were splitting up due to her addiction and her behavior as a result of it. And we became a divorced family, visitation on the weekends with my mom, living with my dad the rest of the time. And from there, it kind of, my mom kind of slowly spiraled out of control more over time. She wasn't as fortunate as I was to find recovery. And she ended up dying as a result of her addiction when I was 16 years old.
Wow. So from the time you were 10, or probably earlier, but to 16, you got to watch your mother's descent into this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed by people, and we know how common it is that for this disease to show up in families. More than one member. I'm always surprised that witnessing that wasn't enough to keep you safe. What were your reasons for using as you watched the effect it was having on your mom?
Well, I remember being it's funny that you said that. I remember being in like fifth or sixth grade, which was like around the time when I first started to experiment with like drinking a little bit here and there, smoking a cigarette, whatever. And the topic of addiction got brought up in my classroom, and my teacher mentioned that families of children of addicts tend to also become addicts themselves. And I was like the only one in my class that proudly raised my hand and said that, like, I don't think that's true, because maybe because you watch somebody go through that, you wouldn't want to do it yourself. Little did I know, that the complete opposite would be my life. That was my line of thinking when I was in the fifth or sixth grade as well, my reasons for using, I guess I never, all of this came out way later, when I finally sought help, but I think I never really processed what happened to my mom when I was a kid, and that led me to use. And I had a lot of anger back then, and I didn't. It was very misdirected, and I just wanted to numb myself. I don't remember being sad back then about things that were going on, but I'm guessing, you know, I was, and I just didn't know how to express that, and that turned into, you know, alcohol and drugs.
At what age?
I started drinking when I was 10, 11, 12, and then it slowly turned into other stuff, pot, you know, whatever was around, whatever I could get my hands on. I always hung out with older kids when I was younger. So.
Yeah, that's another pattern you see.
Yeah.
You're looking for like-minded individuals. Where were you in the family order? Were you the oldest, youngest? Where were you?
I was the youngest.
So you're the youngest. What was going on with your siblings?
She was over excelling in school and getting straight A's.
Right.
I was getting straight A's too, but, on top of that also, I was the problem kid, you know, I was always getting in trouble, whether it was graffiti or, you know, getting caught smoking a cigarette or whatever else I was getting myself into.
Yeah. Were you aware at all during that period of time that you were sort of assigned that role, or it felt like you were assigned that role? Like your sister was the good kid, so you should be the bad kid. Was that a conscious thought in your head?
I don't think so. Like, I never really envied her or anything. It was more like we were in everything that happened to us together.
So you got along with her?
Yeah. We fought like a lot growing up, but then once the stuff started to go crazy with my mom, I think that we banded together in that. And you know, she was doing like other things as well, but we just. I was worse at hiding things than she was, I think.
Well, she didn't. Did she have a substance abuse problem, or was she just?
No, she didn't. She never has.
Yeah. Which is again fascinating. Same background, same situation, and you can never tell how this thing is going to shake out, right? So, was Dad aware of what was going on with you? I mean, could he see what was happening?
I mean, I think he just brushed a lot of stuff off as typical kid stuff. He grew up in, like, you know, a time where kids were allowed to roam around the neighborhood and get in trouble and things like that. His number one thing he would always tell me was to fly under the radar. You know, he didn't care if I was, like, doing, you know, smoking a little bit of pot or whatever it was, as long as I wasn't getting in trouble for it, as long as I wasn't, you know, getting arrested, and that he didn't find out about it, he wouldn't have cared, is what his, you know, line of thinking was.
Mm-hmm. And he also had his hands full, I suppose, with your mom, even though they weren't living together.
Yeah, my mom was another story. she was very open to all of that stuff going on. So,
when you say anger fueled a lot of your substance abuse, can you look back now and figure out what it was you were angry about?
I guess I was angry about, you know, having to watch my mom go through that. I was mostly angry at her for... I didn't understand why she would give up her family for her addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now, but back then I saw it as a big betrayal.
Yeah, like she was doing this to you people.
Yeah.
She was, inflicting this on you. Take me through the progression of your use. It begins like every other kid your age, little drinking on the weekends and then some pot. And tell me about your progression and how quick it was.
I started drinking. I remember, like, I would play guitar. I had a lot of hobbies when I was little. I was doing art, I was playing music, this and that, and I would use all of those things to escape my feelings. And then one day when I found drinking, I guess it was just like finishing some drinks or whatever that were laying around after my dad had friends over or something. I don't remember exactly when it was, but I remember thinking that it was so much easier than the gratification I got from playing, like learning a new song or drawing a picture, and that it was instant, you know, I didn't have to work for it. And from there, I mean, it was curiosity that I think, like, I wanted to try all the other things that I could do to alter my consciousness to escape. And, you know, when pot came around, because my friend, I met a person that smoked pot, I was able to try that. So I did that. And then, slowly, as things, like, popped up, I would try them, you know, whatever it was.
Well, so was everybody else in your social circle, I would imagine, experimenting. What was different about your experimentation now that you look back on it?
I guess I was a lot younger than most of them.
Uh-huh.
That's all I could,
right.
You know, I was the only kid, I think, in my class at that grade trying pot and drinking and hanging out with high schoolers, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was a big, that's a big one, because, I mean, back then I wouldn't say that it was like, it wasn't out of control yet, because I didn't have access to any, like, this stuff very often or anything like that, but it was definitely, like, a problem because I was so young. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't make sense.
At what point, did you lose control of it, as you say? When did you start to do it to excess?
Well, there were several points where I thought, you know, I'm an alcoholic or I am an addict.
You actually had those thoughts?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, because I knew what I was doing, and I knew, like, I'd watched my mom go through that. And I remember being in high school and drinking, like, before I would go to school in the morning and being like, this is out of control. You know, like, I'm an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I love this too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I was always, like, I was very self-disciplined, I think, in high school, and very, like, vigilant that I didn't want to go down that path. So I would pull myself out of it and be like, all right, I'm not going to drink anymore before school.
Right.
You know, I'm just going to drink on the weekends with my friends or whatever it was. And then I would bounce back, and I would go, like, several months, like, well, I'm not going to smoke weed for, like, 6 months, and I wouldn't.
Right.
And then I guess that kind of all went out the window when I went to college, because I had freedom for the first time.
Sure.
From, you know, family.
And,
you know, I wasn't under a watch. I wasn't under a household where I was being watched or anything like that.
Yeah, that's another distinguishing characteristic of people abusing drugs and alcohol at your early age, who have this kind of Spartan attitude about, well, look, I got to go to school, I've got to stop this. All of that behavior didn't slow down the disease in you, but it made it harder for other people to see what was happening, right?
Yeah.
Because you were functioning fairly well under the circumstances.
Uh-huh.
And then, as it always is the case, college changes everything. Our guest on the telephone is April Hartman. April, 27 years old. She's a musician, struggles with drugs and alcohol. Growing up, lost her mom during her teenage years to the disease of addiction. April is now over 3 years sober now, having just celebrated an anniversary. We congratulate her on that. She's sharing her story of substance abuse and recovery with us on Recovery Radio. We have more with April. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is my name. We're talking with April Hartman. Incidentally, I sort of buried this lead here. April is among the alumni who have gone through Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. It's a group that's growing now. We're going to talk a little bit about, you know, what they do, how often they meet. With April straight ahead, but she's sharing with us her story now. So April, again, you're able to sort of juggle being a high school student and abusing alcohol and doing a little too many drugs and still get through school. What changes when you get to college? I mean, the shackles are off now, right?
Yeah, I had freedom. I think another big thing was I got in a relationship that was very toxic early in college.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, you know, had a lot of addictive tendencies. So that kind of, like, you know, two addicts get together and you just take off. We started trying a lot more stuff that I hadn't tried yet, namely opiate pills. So my second and third year of college were very, very crazy and driven by that.
Looking back, can you now appreciate that it wasn't a coincidence that you found this person and got into this relationship?
Probably not. It taught me a lot of stuff, and it taught me that I shouldn't date people like that.
Yeah. But again, you're trying. The addict is trying to normalize their behavior, and the only way to do that is to be around other people who are engaged in the same behavior, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going through a lot of self-hatred at that time. With body image, a lot of different things. And I think I dove into drugs to try to, and also, you know, the stress of being a college student. I was in a very intensive major, a science major. And, I somehow managed to graduate. You know, I got good grades through that year and the year after and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still able to maintain that, you know, outside, you know, holding my life together outside of my addiction.
Yeah, for people listening now who don't understand this or want to get their heads around it, April's story is in one sense fairly typical. She's a high achiever. She's managed to, as she just said, work her way through a difficult college academic career and hold up that end of it while spiraling downward into this drug addiction and substance abuse, it demonstrates the cruelty of this disease, that it can allow some people to maintain some kind of equilibrium while they still abuse drugs and alcohol. It's a very insidious process. So you graduated from college, April?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the same as when I was in high school. I had like around my fourth year, I was in college for 5 years. Around my fourth year, I had some kind of epiphany where I was like, I can't do this anymore. I shouldn't be doing opiates. They're destroying my life. And I stopped completely and finished my last year, not sober, but not, you know, doing opiates.
You weren't taking them intravenously at that point?
No.
Okay. You were able to cut out the opiates, still a little drinking, still some pot.
Yeah, whatever else, psychedelics or whatever I was experimenting with at that time.
Looking back now, what other consequences of your use can you remember? Were there health problems? Did you get in trouble with the law? What was going on in your life?
I didn't really have any consequences. I mean, I guess, like, I did definitely, my relationship suffered. My relationship with my family probably suffered looking back, but I didn't have any legal consequences, health issues yet. I did end up having to get a surgery on my nose that may or may not have been escalated by sniffing drugs, but it could have been allergies. I don't know for sure.
Had your mom passed away before you got to college?
Yeah, when I was 16.
Yeah. So, was she aware that you were going hard, before she passed away? Was there ever any moment where she said, "What are you doing?"
We used to drink together and smoke weed together, so that was, she knew those things, but I didn't, that was it. At that time, if something came around, I might have tried mushrooms or whatever, but
have you wondered anything else. Have you ever wondered why it is you would begin resenting your mom because you didn't understand the nature of her problem, and then wind up sharing the problem with her? Have you ever taken a look at that? And I wonder what you think about it.
I have no idea.
Is it just a question of, misery loves company, or is that a way for you? It was a way for you to bond with your mother, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the only thing we shared at that point.
Well, again, for people who do not know this disease and what it's capable of doing, when they view behavior like that, it just strikes people as craziness.
Yeah.
I mean, craziness. It doesn't surprise me. I've heard these stories before. It doesn't surprise me you would be doing drugs and a little alcohol with your mom. It's the only thing you guys had in common.
Yeah.
I want to pick up the story going straight ahead because, as we know, obviously, you reach a point where you go, okay, I got to stop doing this. You said you did that briefly there towards the end, but you didn't cut out everything.
No, and I graduated college, and I went into my first job. It was very, very labor intensive, and it was different. I remember breaking down right before I graduated, because for the first time I realized that I was going to be in the world, in the real world, with nothing telling me what to do at any point. Because even up until that point in my life, there was always somebody telling me what to do. There was always a class I had to be to on time that I had to get, a B or an A in. I had a job or whatever it was. There was something that was telling me what to do, like some semblance of order, of control over my life. And when I graduated, I didn't have that. It was completely open. I could do anything I wanted. And that scared me because I didn't know what I would do with that freedom.
And you were worried what you would do with the freedom is fill it up with bad behavior.
So I got my first job out of college. I was making really good money. I was working long hours. I was tired. And a lot of other things happened. I lost a relationship during that time. My grandmother died during that time in the winter after. And a lot of those things caused me to, I saw the numbness that I had from opiates. I'd been drinking and stuff like that. And, the drinking slowly turned out of control until it was every day again. And then I wanted the next thing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the next level, and I remembered, that opiates felt better, and this and that, and I rationalized in my head that was what I needed. At that time, it was it was past the point where pills were readily available, and they weren't anymore, and it was heroin that was available. So that's when I started using heroin.
April Hartman is our guest. April is 3.5 years sober now. She's bringing us into her story of substance abuse and eventual sobriety. She's successfully now helping others with this disease. April's a musician. We're going to find out about all of that straight ahead. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. We're going to get back to our guest, April Hartman, in a second. A reminder, though, that the whole thing here is sponsored by the good, good people at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We're talking today with a member of their alumni group, and we will have more of these programs in the weeks ahead, but I want to tell you a little bit about Retreat. Actually, I just want to give you their phone number. This is simple. Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, they are justifiably proud of the work they do. They have an unbelievable reputation. They are leaders in the field of treating the disease of addiction. They give you the phone number as an informational tool and hope you never have to use it. If you have any questions or comments about anything concerning the disease of addiction, they're there to answer the questions for you. If they can provide the help they think you need, then trust me, you will be in good hands at Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. But here's the number. Questions or comments, 855-859-8808. That's how you reach them, 855-859-8808, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. April Hartman is with us on the telephone, young musician, 27 years old, now 3.5 years sober, telling us, you know, how she got on that successful path. So April, you know, faced with the uncertainty of having to grow up, being adult, being in the real world, you say that opiates went from pharmaceutical opiates to street drugs. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the only thing that was around anymore. I found the one friend that I knew I had that was doing bad stuff, and I linked up with them like we usually do, and it went from there. I ended up in a relationship with another addict, as I usually do. I always have a running partner, so eventually I quit my job, and I moved in, like, basically with my sister, but more so living in my car. And I kept trying to run away from myself during that period of time and thinking, you know, I could stop using if I just get out of New Jersey. I was living in New Jersey. That's where I went to college. And I kept thinking, if I get out of New Jersey, I won't be able to find anything. So I would drive to Florida to, like, visit friends down there. And I would end up, you know, going online on the internet and finding something down there. And starting all over again. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to drive to New Orleans. And then I ended up doing the same thing there.
When you say you would go on the internet and find something down there, what did you mean? Find what down there?
Oh, find heroin.
On the internet?
Yeah.
How's that work?
Oh, well, I would find people that, you know, were using through online forums. And then eventually that would lead to.
Again, for people who aren't clear on this, when you say online forums, things like Reddit?
Yeah.
Was that the platform you basically used?
Yeah, it's funny that you know that.
Well, I've been talking to a lot of people. This is a cautionary tale for people wondering how this stuff happens. I mean, how could a girl, young girl, no contacts, very few resources, jump in a car and manage to, you know, hook up with a drug dealer in Florida? When do you decide that this cannot go on any longer?
Well, I kept doing the thing where I would leave New Jersey and drive around. And eventually, I got to a point where I was at my sister's house. And I had been using, like, I started doing cocaine and, like, all different, like, intravenously, all different drugs. Because heroin wasn't really working anymore. I had such a high tolerance to it. I wasn't getting high anymore. I wasn't losing myself in the experience anymore. I couldn't shut my brain off with the drugs anymore. So I started using all these different drugs to try to shut my brain off, and it wouldn't work. No matter how much I did, I couldn't get high anymore. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't turn the voices off inside my head, my own voice inside my head, you know. And so one day there, I guess I just reached a breaking point, and it was honestly either that I wanted to die or I wanted to live. So I was either trying to kill myself or I was going to try something else. And I realized in one moment that I could do all the drugs in the entire world and I would still be myself. Mm-hmm. And I hated myself more than anything.
What?
But it would never change me into somebody I wasn't. And I didn't want to hate myself anymore. And I knew that at that point, the only thing there was for me to do was kill myself or to try something completely different. And the day after that was when I went into treatment. Not at retreat. I went to a detox for a week, and then I went to retreat.
Yeah. How did you get to detox? Did you go to a physician or a friend? How did you make the decision to get into detox and then to the retreat?
I sent my sister a text. She was sleeping in the same house as me, but I sent her a text and said, hey, when you wake up, I need to talk to you. And when she got up, I said, hey, I need to go to, like, rehab today. And we called around until we found somewhere that would let me in.
Yeah. Tell me about the detox experience. Were you scared? What was going through your mind during? Were you grateful or what?
I wasn't really scared anymore. I was more scared of myself than I was of anything else.
Let me ask you a question, by the way, before we get, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you say you either were going to die or you were going to do something about this problem, was that a conscious, I mean, were you saying I'll kill myself, or were you just saying if this keeps up, I'll die? Do you know what I mean? There's a difference between saying I'm going to commit suicide and recognizing that your reckless behavior will kill you. Which was it for you?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that day I was trying to kill myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm just going to try to shoot this cocktail of drugs and go to sleep forever. But every time I did it, I would wake up again, you know, like 5 minutes later, and I'd be like, I'm still here. All right. You know?
Yeah. When we talk about bottoms, that's a kind of a buzzword, hitting bottom. You got to get to the bottom. There are all kinds of bottoms. Another way to put that, it sounds like you're saying, is a moment when you realize it's like you're not looking for the bottom. You're looking for something that works, and the drugs aren't working anymore.
Yes. It was very much, I think, a spiritual bottom for me, because I didn't have a bottom with legal problems or a bottom with running out of money or my health. It was a spiritual bottom for me.
Yeah, what you were doing, you ran out of gas.
Yeah.
So your sister gets you to detox, the detox goes down, and then you get yourself to retreat. Tell us about your experience with retreat.
I picked retreat because they gave me a couple options when I was in detox. And they said, do you want to go to Florida or do you want to go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania? And I said, well, I was just in Florida, and I found drugs down there, and I'm kind of tired of it because I was already down there. So, because at that point, I was still very much into adventuring, and I still am into, like, traveling and exploring different areas of the country. So I said, well, let me go to Lancaster. In my brain, I thought Lancaster was one giant farmland, you know, in the middle of Pennsylvania. And I thought, great, I'll be isolated from everything, and I'll stay clean. It wasn't what I thought it was. I mean, I from the pamphlet I got when I was in detox retreat, seems like some kind of, like, hippie commune. It had, like, a picture of, like, a teepee, and it said that they do drum circles and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, okay, that sounds like what I'm into. And I got there, and there was a teepee, but we couldn't use it. There was drum circles, and I did enjoy those while I was there. I think a big thing I learned from my time in retreat is I met a lot of great people in there that were musicians and that were willing to sit with me and teach me things and encourage me, because I up until that point, I was very self-critical with music. I never wanted to do it because I always thought I would never be good enough. But I met people in there like Bernard, and I met other musicians in there that were doing music and that convinced me that it's something I could do. Another thing I did in there, I think, was really work through the stuff with my mom. I had a really good counselor that helped me deal with that, that helped me work through the grief. That was the first time I had done anything like that. But I really approached being in rehab as an open book. I didn't want to ever have to go there again. So I was going to do whatever they told me to do that they thought would help me so that I never had to go there again. You know, every single counselor that gave me a piece of advice, I took that piece of advice. Any single person that talked to me and said, you should go to a recovery house, I did that. And I really took advantage, you know, I was like, I'm paying for this. I'm going to take advantage
yeah, right.
of all the treatment, everything, you know. And I think that's a big mistake that a lot of people don't do. They're not as open to taking advantage of the
yes.
of the counseling and stuff like that. But I very much was like, I wanted to get not my money's worth, but like I wanted to get what I you know, you get what you put into it. And so I put all the effort I could into that that I would never have to go there again.
Well, there's a common thread in your story. You seem like a goal-oriented person. I mean, you set out to do things and you wanted to see a positive or some result from them. And unfortunately, that attitude also extended into your substance abuse.
Yeah.
So you were the same sort of goal-oriented person. It's a great insight, though, because you're right. When people get to a treatment facility, they are going to get out of it exactly what they put into it, correct?
Yes.
And
yeah, absolutely.
And for you, you know, one of the sort of incentives was they brought out this musical side of you. We're going to pick up on that notion of the role that music played and what went on for April when she got to retreat straight ahead. Stay with us. This is Recovery Radio. We're back on Recovery Radio. Our guest on the telephone is April Hartman. April is an alumni of the work done at Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Center. She has taken us through her story of substance abuse and now her 3.5 years of sobriety. We appreciate that. April, we're going to get into the alumni stuff straight ahead, but I want to just finish up here on your treatment. You arrived at Retreat, very positive attitude. This is something you want to succeed at. You can't. You've made up your mind you can no longer continue the way you were going or you would probably die. And you sort of find music in a strange sense there. You'd been musical prior to going into treatment. What changed for you when you got to Retreat regarding your work as a musician?
There was one person that I want to credit. Her name is Lily. She's a really, really great singer, also another alum of Retreat that I met in there. And at one point, I was playing a song on guitar, and I wanted her to sing for me. And we were going to perform at the talent show that you guys, not talent show, but like a coffee house open mic that they do there.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me that I wasn't as bad as I thought I was, and that I should just sing it myself. And like that single sentence, "You're not as bad as you think you are," never ever resonated with me in my entire life as much as it did in that moment. And I realized at that moment that that was what was holding me back, that I thought I was worse than I actually was.
Beyond music, just in general, you didn't think much of yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a single sentence, I think, that changed my life at that point. So when I got out, I chased music as hard as I could. You know, I got my own guitar. You know, I bought one at the pawn shop as soon as I got to the recovery house. I started learning more songs. I started playing more. And eventually somebody asked me to play a show in Lancaster. And I was like, no way. Like, my first show. And everybody that came to support me were people that were in recovery. My friends from the recovery houses came. You know, people from the fellowships out here came. And it was just this amazing feeling. It was like, it was a rush better than drugs had ever given me.
That's wonderful. Let me ask you, what are you doing now? Are you a working musician now? Is this what you do?
Yeah, I do music now. I've been playing. I have a band together that I've been playing with for around 2 years now. We made an album a year ago. We've toured 3 times across the United States in this time. This is my life now. It's my passion. It's what I do. And I make it a point when I perform to always say that I'm in recovery. A lot of our music is recovery oriented. And I'll usually, you know, before one or two of those songs, I'll say, hey, I've been sober for like three years. And if you ever, I say that not to brag, but because if there's somebody out there in the audience that, you know, needs help with something or that has a family member struggling with something, like, just know you're not alone. There's people like you out here that are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're available to talk to, we're resources, and that we're in it together. In doing that, I've met people all over the place that are doing the same thing that I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know?
April, do you perform in places where alcohol is served?
Yes, I do.
And in the music business, we know it has an unfortunate history of attracting a lot of drug abuse. So let me ask you a simple question. Is staying sober difficult for you in that context?
No. I mean, for me, it's always been, what are my intentions in being in this space? If my intentions of going to a concert were to be to drink beer and sit in the back, I'm not there for the music. Every time I walk into a setting like that, I'm there to perform. I'm there for the music. And that's what's on my mind. It's not about the drinking or whatever it is. You know, it's there, but it's not what I'm focused on.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, whereas in the past, going to concerts were about, you know, sitting in the back and drinking beer for me. So that's been an eye-opening thing, too. Like, going to shows sober has been amazing, and I can appreciate the music so much more than I had when I was drinking or doing drugs.
April, what's the name of the band?
Apes of the State.
Say again?
Apes of the State.
You have a website or something, or people can buy your CD?
Yeah, we're on Instagram, Facebook, apesofthestate.com, anything, anywhere you could have a website or a page, we're on it.
So you now help other people who are struggling with the substance abuse, and you through your music. In that regard, what are you doing?
We started up, me and my partner started up this organization called Second Chance to Play. And what we do with that is we collect old guitars that are sitting in people's houses not being used, or that maybe they're getting rid of, and fix them up and then give them to people that are in recovery. We give them to rehabs so that, you know, Retreat has like a whole wall of guitars in there. But there's other rehabs that don't have instruments in them. So we give them to rehabs and treatment centers and recovery houses so that there's a guitar sitting there, because every place I've been to speak or whatever, there's always somebody there that knows how to play, or that, you know, was like me and gave up playing at a young age or whatever it was. And them being able to pick that up again, it really brightens the atmosphere of the facility. But in addition to that, they might be able to use it like a tool for their recovery, like I did. Mm-hmm. So we put those there so that they could be had. We also run an open mic in town every week, every Thursday at the Raise Project on East Orange Street in Lancaster. We have a recovery open mic jam session. In the colder months, like in the fall, we have a campfire outside for it. And then in the spring, in the summer when it's like a little too hot, we do it inside. And in the winter when it's cold. But yeah, we all get together there and play together. And that's just that the point of that is to just have a safe environment where people can play and express themselves and maybe express their feelings about being in recovery and being a musician, because the music scene in Lancaster is very heavily tied to the bar scene. There's very few concerts and open mics you could go to that aren't in bars.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is my trying to remedy that situation. We do shows there sometimes. We try to organize other shows in town that are for people in, you know, more marketed towards people in recovery, featuring artists that are in recovery and that are in sober spaces.
Well, that's great. I mean, you took a tough path to find your way, but it sounds like you're right in the groove you should be in. Good for you. Congratulations on the sobriety.
Thank you.
Are you confident that you can stay sober?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any intentions of not. Every time I think that it would be a good idea, I just remember that I've gained so much and that it's not worth throwing away for anything. You know, I wouldn't give up the feeling I have performing for any drug or drink or anything like that. I wouldn't give up the satisfaction it gives me to help other people.
April, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio, and good luck. Take care, everybody. See you next week on Recovery Radio.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.